You are with RCR 360. Of course, I am Marie. Joining me now is Professor Elizabeth Rata. Elizabeth is a curriculum expert and sociologist at the University of Auckland, a member of various ministerial advisory groups. She co-chairs the Inter-University Academic Freedom Council, and her research explores the effects of racial categorisation in education, leading her to a theory of neo-tribal capitalism, which critiques the privatisation of public resources in New Zealand. She directs the Knowledge and Education Research Unit and has authored influential works, including A Political Economy of Neo-Tribal Capitalism and the Research Handbook on Curriculum and Education. She was also a founding member of Kura Kau Papa Māori. Hello, Elizabeth, and welcome along to RCR 360. It's great to have you here today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Marie.
You gave your oral submission at the Treaty Principles hearings, Select Committee hearings. And I think it has been fair to say that you have set both the online world and the media world alight, and you've had a great reaction to that. So what have been some of the reactions that you've had personally from that oral submission that you gave?
Well, because I'm not on social media, I don't actually know what people have been saying about it, except for those who have emailed me, and with very, very supportive and comments, which I greatly appreciate.
Yeah, it has. Well, I can let you know, certainly on X, you have been quite the talk of the town. And part of that talk is your submission was so eloquent, and I'm going to start with the opening paragraph of that submission, which goes, "What is the best title given to any New Zealand legislation? My money is on the 1877 Education Act, an act to make further provision for the education of the people of New Zealand, the people of New Zealand. So as early as the 1870s, there's a commitment to the united people who belong to and benefit from the nation New Zealand. Nearly 150 years later, that commitment is under serious threat from those who will replace liberal democracy with tribal sovereignty and by doing so, create a racialized society. Apartheid." That's potent stuff, Elizabeth. What brought you to write something so powerful, and where have we gone wrong since 1870?
It's not really powerful. It's just an objective description of what actually has happened. You know, the 19th century was a century of nation building. Well, actually, right up until the 1960s, you know, people were committed, New Zealanders committed to the idea of New Zealand. The word New Zealand was really important. You know, you'd describe yourself as a New Zealander. The notion that you had political and legal status as a New Zealander really mattered. Here was this nation that had built itself up in such a short time. I look at what the colonialists and also Māori did in the 19th century, and I am filled with awe. I mean, what they built the nation. I mean, imagine putting in things like sanitation systems, water systems. I mean, we had a lot of typhoid in this country in the 19th century, so clean water really mattered. People were committed to those sorts of things, the infrastructure, you know, the national infrastructure. And to me, as an educationalist, the best of all was that wonderful education system that was put in place. I mean, the 1877 Act actually lists the subjects in the curriculum, just highlight the fact they're called subjects, and the subjects are academic subjects, but they're also there's also drawing, there's also the notion of they're creative, there's singing, and then there's technical, because obviously who had to build the little cottages people lived in, who had to make the clothes people wore, or who had to spin the wool to start with. These 19th century New Zealanders, Māori and colonialists, were incredible people. And the majority of them, the vast majority, were committed to building the nation. And we know that because if they hadn't been, we would not have a nation today.
So they would replace liberal democracy with tribal sovereignty. So for people out there, give us a definition of liberal democracy, because I think that that has been hijacked a little and revised in this doublespeak world that we live in. So what is your definition of liberal democracy?
Well, it's very clear. Liberal democracy is the is parliamentary sovereignty, and parliament is the institution where people who represent the people sit and make decisions on our behalf and are accountable to us, the citizens. It's as clear as that. We are not the United States. We do not have a balance of power arrangements between the executive, legislative area and judiciary. We have one overarching decision maker, and that is Parliament. And Parliament represents and is accountable to us, the people. Hence the word member of Parliament, representative, the word representative. They represent us, and the main important point is they are accountable to us. So as citizens, we have to be really actively involved. We have to know what our members of parliament are doing, because they're doing it on our behalf, and we have to hold them accountable, and of course in a very rational way. So liberal democracy, if you think of the word liberal from Latin liber, to be free, the idea that we as people are free to be included in decision making, and the mechanism for doing it is our citizen status.
So then those who believe in this tribal sovereignty, and I think that there is a wish on their part that they speak for all Māori. I think one of the members of Te Pāti Māori even said that once, that he speaks for all Māori. This tribal sovereignty concept, where is it derived from? Because what you have described in a number of pieces of literature interview in your submission is that in a way that there is a certain amount of revisionist history going on here. So how did something like this tribal sovereignty take root, and what is the purpose that they're hoping to do in our democracy moving forward?
Well, revising history is one of the strategies used by a very small group of people who emerged in the 1970s and who were able to hijack a global movement from democratic politics to identity politics, and hijack that movement in order to be able to say our identity is that of the indigenous people of this country, and we have rights for that reason. But even the idea of indigeneity, being indigenous, really is a new idea. In fact, the truth is that we're all migrants, whether we came in the 15th century, 14th century, 19th, 18th, 21st century, we're all migrants to this country. But that's not so much the point, as it was the 1852 Constitution Act that established our constitution. I mean, it was a fairly basic document. You've got to start somewhere. And since then, we've built it, we've made it more sophisticated, we've refined it. But New Zealand began with the 1852 Constitution Act, which is the reason I'd like to see it as a recognised as our founding document. But to get back to the what I call the neo-tribal elite, this is a small group of people. I call them tribalists. They have used the treaty as a mechanism to justify their claim to power and to considerable resources. And when I say considerable, we're talking about water, flora, fauna, land, seabed, radio waves, a huge list of, and they're not just resources, they are the resources that we use to produce wealth. They are the productive resources. So any small group of people that is able to get hold of these resources really is able to take over the country. This is what happened in South America in the 19th century. We're seeing it happen here. And what the small group does is it justifies its claim to power and resources by using tradition, by saying, we have the right to this because, and then you get this revised notion of a traditional society. Claims that somehow disparate tribes pre-1840 were a sovereign nation. They were not. But you have the revision of history and the treaty used as the manifesto, given the sort of spiritual mandate, so that it makes it above our challenge and criticism. And one of the methods you've done, one of the methods that education has been involved in here is two ways. The first is to teach this revisionist history, including that the treaty is a partnership when it is not, and also to promote culture, ethnic culture, as the culture of the school. But the culture of the school is a culture of knowledge, of the transmission of knowledge, of children learning to both be individuals and to be part of society, you know, to understand what authority is, to understand how to be critical, all those sorts of things. That's the culture of the school. It's not the culture of your ethnic group. That's your home culture, like religion.
So how do you fix it? Because I mean, you referred before where this came from, which is the heart of critical race theory, which is very much an American construct that has obviously come through tertiary academia, come into this nation, and now across many generations move through into our education system. How do you weed that out? What is the solution here?
Well, critical race theory is just the latest of a number of movements. The main one is Marx's critical theory from the 70s, which was hijacked, which was used by this group. Postmodernism, this idea that there is no truth, that everything is relative, that was another way of thinking used to justify this approach. But we can turn it around, and the way to turn it around is to have a curriculum that is subject-based, where young people, pupils, and students at secondary school are taught specific subjects. And in the acquisition of subject knowledge, which is difficult, which is abstract, which is not connected to their everyday lives, in fact, should not be connected. This type of knowledge must be difficult because in its very difficulty builds the mind. It must not be relevant to everyday life because it is the knowledge which takes us out of our everyday lives into the world. We need a curriculum that is solidly subject-based, that is rigorous, really rigorous, and that is taught by teachers who know the subject well and who have high standards for their students. And of course, some students will, you know, love all subjects and do very well. Others will just get to a certain point. That's not the what matters. What matters that in the having being forced to acquire this really difficult abstract knowledge, that is how we build our minds. If we don't have the knowledge, we don't build our mind in a way that enables us to think about what we don't experience. We are just simply limited to our local experience, to our culture. And that, of course, is what this particular group of revisionist tribalists want. Restrict people, keep them confined to their heritage cultures.
It's almost confining them to a prison of their own making, isn't it? So then you're sort of really talking about replacing lived experience and education with actual empirical knowledge. Meritocracy, restoring meritocracy, how important is that in our educational system today?
Absolutely important. We consider it essential in sport. Surely, merit is important in education. Not everyone is good at everything. That's one of the things as young people we have to learn. That's the way of the world. But we must have an education system, especially universities, based on merit. So that is the challenge to children. You know, when you know that you can get better marks, that you can, and more importantly than the marks, that you can understand something that's quite difficult. I mean, there's a wonderful challenge in that. And that's the challenge that our children and young people are not getting at the moment.
So I've heard you talk about concept of partial loyalty as a way, as a tool to help improve our education system and get us out of this quagmire that we are in currently. Talk me through partial loyalty. What is it?
Well, partial loyalty is an essential feature of liberal democracy because what it does, it enables us to be loyal to our role as a citizen, where we are required to be critical, and it enables us to be loyal to our specific cultural group, our family, our home, the wider community group, where our religion, where any other community type group, where we don't want to be critical. We want to belong to the group because, to the family, because that's where we get our psychological security. It's where we get our so feeling of social belonging. So partial loyalty is when we can be totally loyal to our emotional group, and we can be loyal to our nation, but that is a loyalty requiring us to be critical. So this is why it's difficult to be a modern person. We have to be, at the same time, these two opposing things. We have to be able to be critical, and we also want to belong and feel secure. So that's the modern world. Traditional world, and if we lived in an autocracy, then you can't be partially loyal. You have to be totally loyal.
So then that also drives into the fact as well, in terms of loyalty, it's a great way of having compromise, isn't it? So allowing you to be yourself at home, but also understand the importance of pillars of education and democracy moving forward. Because the culture now has been one of absolutes. You either, and I guess that comes back to your tribalism, isn't it? You have to be absolutely in one camp or another. Partial loyalty allows you to have a foot in both, as it were. Lastly, freedom of speech and censorship and self-censorship. I know I speak to my sons about this at school, that they get frustrated, that they feel that they can't always speak their minds because the attitudes are very entrenched in terms of absolutes, absolutes around theories and ideologies such as climate or gender or Indigenous relationships. How important is it for our students and also our educators to have freedom of speech, to speak their minds and discuss and have discourse in the educational sphere?
Well, first of all, you have to have a mind. And you're not just born with a mind. You develop your mind and you develop it through engagement with ideas that are difficult and that are challenging. That's how you build your mind. It takes 13 years at school and then the rest of your life by constantly engaging with the type of ideas that force your mind to engage. So, you know, you've got to have a mind first. And then once, as you build your mind, you're able to take part in informed discussion. Now, not just giving your opinion, it must be informed opinion. Where do you get your informed opinion from? You get it from wide reading, from initially when you're young, from being taught about a subject. And as you become older, you're able to start to criticize through wide reading. And that way you acquire informed opinion. And I think at that point, you are able to take part in, you are able to use your free speech. instead of just sort of emoting in some random way where you misunderstand free speech to mean you simply, as I say, emote, express strong emotions and all your feelings. No, free speech requires informed opinion.
I almost feel like that needs to have the title of Elizabeth Rata's Guide for Social Media. Look, just finally, you're doing work now with our curriculum. Can you share with us a little bit of what that work entails and what the goals for the curriculum are moving forward for our young New Zealanders in education?
Well, I can't give you detail, but I can say, and I've said this on many occasions, and I've just said it previously, actually, curriculum must be subject-based. My interest is, and my background is in English. So what is English as a subject? It's English language and it's English literature. And also, too, you know, the history of English language and literature and how we've developed a New Zealand form of English language and literature. So, you know, that's where we start, with being absolutely clear about what the subject is, and then we can make decisions about what is this English language, what is this English literature that we must teach, and obviously Shakespeare would be central to both language and literature. I mean, imagine trying to teach chemistry without the periodic table. That would be like teaching English without Shakespeare.
And I don't think many children today realise how many words and phrases in the everyday vernacular have a Shakespearean origin. It is a boggling amount. And
incredible.
It is incredible. And that was something I was taught in English at school, and I'm stunned that they no longer do it. So, Elizabeth, thank you so much for your time today. This has been very enlightening. This has been Professor Elizabeth Rata here with RCR 360. Thank you.